I thrive in chaos. The more chaotic the environment, the more I succeed in it. I am not good with quiet. I am not good with stillness. Honestly, I was chasing dollar signs, which is not how you find purpose. When you're chasing purpose, dollars show up. If you can embrace the concept and the idea of gratitude, so many things will begin to unfold in front of you. My favorite is when you get that big burly guy who's probably on SWAT for 15 of his 20 years, sitting back there, he was voluntold to be in the class. That's the first guy to cry. That's the first person that's going to have the most benefits from the program. I've never had anybody come out of one of these classes that says that they didn't think it was the best class they've ever had.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with David Berez. He's a retired police officer and public safety consultant. And we'll be talking about resiliency, officer mental health, and transition into retirement with purpose and positive psychology tools, all through the lens of David's own experiences. Please like and subscribe, YouTube, Respond to Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., and Responder TV. bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, and all the podcast platforms. Go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with David after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilient strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Responder Resilience. We co-host retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. And today we're speaking with David Berez. He's a retired police officer and drug recognition expert, having served more than 20 years with the East Windsor, New Jersey Police Department and a total of 33 years in emergency services. Mr. Berez is the president and founder of 6-4 Consultants. It's a public safety consulting firm. And Mr. Berez is also a published author, featured columnist, guest speaker, and panelist on a variety of public safety discussions. He's a resiliency program officer and master resiliency trainer and facilitator for Resilient Minds on the Front Lines, The Power of Our Story, and a consultant for New Jersey's State Resilience Program for Law Enforcement. In 2022, David was named to the Law Enforcement Advisory Council for Citizens Behind the Badge, and he's currently earning his master's in Applied Positive Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. David, warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here with you all.
It's great to have you. You certainly have a lot going on, which we love.
It's been an amazing journey. It's been a very incredible experience that I just grateful for, and grateful to have the opportunity to now give back as well.
Well, great. Let's dive in.
Yeah.
So on that note, could you just give us the Cliff Note version of this journey, like where you began and how you arrived at where you are now?
Absolutely. Dave does such a great job of that. I'll see where I can fill in the gaps. It's always weird to hear your own bio read back to you. It's a very interesting phenomenon every time that happens. I started as a volunteer EMT when I was 14 years old with the local rescue squad where I grew up. For me, it was a great way to get out of my house and be part of something that was bigger than myself and kind of avoid the tumult that was happening in my house in my family life. And so I had some great parental figures there and some great friends. And that's kind of what got me started on the journey. By 16, I was an EMT, 18, a rescue technician. And then I went off to college at Hofstra University in Long Island. I started out that academic journey wanting to be a doctor because of the squad.
Sure.
And I failed botany my freshman year, and that was the end of my medical experiences. But yeah, so I ended up getting into the police world and public safety, and had a 20-year career as a police officer in New Jersey. And that started out as a special in the boardwalk and Seaside. I'm sure everybody's seen the shows and watched some of that chaos unfold. And then I got hired full time in East Windsor, where I spent the bulk of my career. And after I retired, I ended up muddling my way through what was next. And purpose found me, unfortunately, to be honest with you. It came as the result of the suicide of a very close friend, my buddy Danny, and my inability to properly process that. And I then got into the New Jersey Resiliency Program, which was brand new. And we can go more in detail into that, which then started me on this resiliency journey to then give back to the law enforcement community and other first responders to give them the tools that I was so grateful to have gotten through the resiliency program. Hmm.
Can you talk about some of your own mental health challenges before, during, and you're alluding to some after?
Absolutely. So when I look at my own mental health challenges, I go pre-me, before me. So my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. So when they came to this country, they came with their own set of baggage, literally and figuratively, because that's all they had was bags. And they came, you know, very little. They found their way through that American life with literally nothing, selling one pencil at a time until they were able to buy a chicken farm. And then they sold eggs to be able to, you know, put my mother and her brother through school. And so their experiences obviously influenced the way I was raised. And then I had some of my own adverse childhood experiences with my parents' divorce, with some, you know, things that happened to me that I note in the book, which I don't know if we want to go too deeply into here. And then my journey through the beginning of my work career, where I was a 9/11 responder, and, you know, you come across so many different types of traumas throughout the course of your career. And you don't realize it at the time, because for the most part, anybody that gets involved in this business, pretty tough individual. You can handle the moment-to-moment stuff, but that stuff accumulates over time and you don't even realize it. So the difference between first responders and military folks is they have a very acute set of experiences that happen in a very short period of time, where we're like the death by a thousand cuts people. Mm-hmm. You go across your career, and it's you don't even recognize how those cuts build up to the point where you're just bleeding trauma all over the place. Mm. And so by the time I got to retirement, I didn't realize how much of that had caught up with me. Mm. And when I retired, I didn't retire with purpose per se, a professional purpose. I was going to be a stay-at-home dad for the most part, which is very purposeful, don't get me wrong, but it's very different than 20 years of running and gunning, you know? And then in that transition process, we had COVID, we had the civil unrest, and, you know, my buddy's suicide. So that is kind of how things built up for me and the mental health challenges that I experienced. And I didn't have really words to define them at the time. So I was muddling through the process of dealing with it, but not dealing with it well. Obviously, alcohol then comes involved. I'm not an alcoholic. I was never an alcoholic. I don't have a substance abuse issue. However, it was used as medication for a period of time. Sure. Where, you know, obviously that's unhelpful.
So there's a bunch of things that you just brought up that I'd love to get a little more deeper into. Let's talk a little bit about chaos and the way that first responders, sometimes it's like their comfort zone, right? Like they thrive in those environments. What was that like for you? How does it kind of relate back to maybe your, you know, family of origin or your childhood, your upbringing? And how did that serve you as a police officer?
I thrive in chaos. I absolutely love the more chaotic the environment, the more I succeed in it. I am not good with silence. I am not good with quiet. I am not good with stillness. It is not for me at all. Mm-hmm. Meditation is not my thing. But we can go more into that later. So growing up, I actually had a very common childhood for the most part, other than my parents' marriage tumult, which is, you know, we've all experienced that. But for me, it was overwhelming. I think, you know, we spoke briefly about this in pre-tape, where ADHD is something that really didn't come about until the early to mid-90s as a diagnosis. However, those of us that likely had it, because it didn't just appear out of nowhere, it's been around, you know, the symptomology has been around for a long time. Right. I was certainly in that realm of symptoms that would be diagnosed today. But we didn't have the language for it. I was just a troubled child.
Yeah.
And academics wasn't my thing. I didn't have the support I needed for all that. And so when I turned 14 and became a member of the rescue squad, and I was in that moment of chaos, that chaos is what fueled me. And that energy that I built in that high volume, high pace is what kept my focus centered.
Sure.
As opposed to the quiet moments where, you know, there's a squirrel, you know, and you're all over the place. So the chaos is actually where I find my calm. And I know that's for first responders, probably quite relatable. The rest of the world, maybe not so much.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a National Alliance of First Responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
You know, we hear that a lot, that their comfort zone is chaos. Mm-hmm. It's something that we hear every single day. I just heard it yesterday. To go back to your point, you know, I became an EMT very young as well, like you, when I was 17. And I remember going on calls and thinking, wow, this is a lot easier than what I had to deal with at home yesterday.
Absolutely.
Like, isn't that crazy? Wow, I can manage this really well, you know? Yeah. And So I understand that piece of you. And I think it's important how you mentioned your grandparents, because that's transgenerational trauma. And we see that getting passed down, you know, in civilians and first responder world.
Exactly.
But first responders are generally coming to this line of work with a lot more of that transgenerational trauma.
Yeah, I agree. And the way I describe it in the book is we all get passed down these bags, which is what transgenerational trauma is.
Yes.
And there's nothing we can do about that. We are going to be carrying those bags for the people that came before us. It's just what it is. Right. Now, us in our generation, wherever the us currently sits, wherever you are in your family, what you can do is you can take some of that stuff out and process it and put it somewhere else. So when it comes your turn to pass the bags, they're a little bit lighter than they were when you got them.
Right.
And for me, that's kind of the analogy that I use with my kids and my family. And if I don't do the work I'm doing for myself now, they're only going to be saddled and burdened with it later.
True.
So I have to, for me, it's so important to lighten those bags up just enough where I can pass them down and they don't have to deal with the things that I have failed to deal with, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think, you know, what's important to mention is that there's a lot of people that don't realize that they have baggage from family members, right? And so when the study came out with adverse childhood experiences, the ACEs test, which anybody can look up online, it's 10 items, you know, you answer it yes or no. What Bonnie and I have discovered is that first responders tend to score higher than average. So if the average score for Americans is a one, you know, first responders are scoring significantly higher than that, you know, so significantly higher would be like a 2, 2.5, a 3. And recognizing that perhaps, you know, your history has contributed to why you want to enter a profession where you can be hands-on and fix it right then and there, whether you're a police officer, a firefighter, you know, an EMT, a paramedic, whatever the case may be, you now have the power in your hands to do something, whereas maybe you came from a situation that left you feeling kind of powerless. So, you know, Bonnie and I always see that connection with our clients. It's a rare first responder that doesn't have a significant ACE or two.
Right.
Yeah. And interestingly, the last study I saw on that, average first responders were between a 5 and a 6.
It depends on the study that you read. Right. So I've studied it extensively, and depending on the study, it's anywhere between 2.5 and 6, you know, so
I'm a 5.
Yeah. I mean, ditto. But what's interesting is we run a peer-to-peer group every week with first responders from all branches. And 1 week we did a little roundtable and we said, okay, we read the questions and we had everyone check in with themselves, and we didn't have them, you know, raise your hand if X happened or number two happened.
No, only if they wanted to volunteer. Yeah.
But we did have everyone add up their numbers, including ourselves. And it was very, very interesting. Because I think once you start to look at it with these lenses, which you're talking about and put in your book, you really start to understand it all. And then you can start to help the next generation and all the other people who haven't gotten there yet.
I agree. And you know, I've never done a study on it per se, but when I've taught the resiliency classes for in different ways and have spoken to different groups, police officers have an incredibly high rate of being sexually abused in their life as well.
I don't know
what the connection is. I have never done an official study on it, but the women are probably somewhere in the 80% range. If I had to like throw a dart on the board, and the men are somewhere in about the 50% range.
Yeah. And my clinical estimation as to like, why do these individuals who have had a history of sexual trauma go on to become, are more likely to go on to become police officers? It's laying down the law. It's righting the wrongs that happen to them.
Absolutely.
You know, they want to make sure that, you know, they're protecting society. They go into a domestic situation. They want to make it right. They were not able to stop what happened to them. Of course, they're not to blame for what happened to them either, but it gives them, I think, a source of vicarious gratification to be able to make a difference, let's say, in a domestic situation.
So. Yeah. And if it's not for the victim themselves, it's almost like retribution as well, where they're getting back towards the offender.
Oh, sure. By the perpetrator. Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
I'm seeing it quite as pervasive in fire EMS dispatch as well. So, you know, I'm not sure what their current research would show in terms of our police the highest. I can't answer that, but I'm seeing it just as pervasively in the other branches as well.
It's sad, actually. It's crazy.
Very sad. But people consciously or subconsciously are trying to right wrongs and do right in the world and make it so that at least one more person doesn't have to live through what they lived through.
Right.
You know, and that's really repairing trauma, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's a way of repairing trauma, but you know, the occupation that you choose gives you some sort of satisfaction that I can fix this situation. I can do something about this situation. I couldn't do anything about my childhood.
It's almost like I think that's who we are, right? I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
It's almost like empowerment. You know, the power that we didn't have in those childhood situations, now we do have if we're showing up to a scene with a position of authority.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think by the nature of it, we're community helpers. That's why we get into this role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
whether it's fire, EMS, police, even dispatchers, any version of the community help role, doctors, nurses too. I'm sure their numbers are pretty high.
Yes,
and absolutely. If you haven't had the experience where you've been wronged or you've had that adverse experience, you don't necessarily have the same connection to being a helper that those that have been affronted do. So it'd be an interesting study across the board with all the community helper roles to see where they've come from, what their journeys look like.
So, yeah. David, what was the turning point for you that put you on the path of supporting officer well-being?
So I've always been a community helper, right, since I was 14 years old. And mm-hmm. when I retired, I retired without the ability to kind of give back. So when I retired, then I went to, what's my next role? How am I going to leverage my training and experience and find a new career in this next part of this journey of my life? And I tried a bunch of different things, you know, and then like everything else in the last few years, COVID happened, right? That's the excuse for everything. COVID happened.
Blame it on COVID.
Yeah, but that's exactly what happened. And so nobody was looking to hire me as a consultant or in a role that I wanted to leverage my experience. As a drug recognition expert, it's very difficult to do that on the legal, you know, buying and selling drugs on the other side of the fence is really not legal. So I couldn't do that. And then being a defense expert really wasn't my thing. I felt like I was betraying the badge, to be quite honest with you. I know a lot of cops go into the defense expert roles. I tried, and I don't know. It wasn't in my heart, and I couldn't do it. I was looking at a few other things as well. And honestly, I was chasing dollar signs, which is not how you find purpose. And it's not how you find meaning in your life. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, when you're chasing the dollars, they don't really show up. When you're chasing purpose, dollars show up. So that transition was unprepared for me, and I didn't know what to do with it. So then July 29th of 2020, in the midst of all of the chaos that was happening at that time, my buddy Danny gave in to his betrayal, and he could no longer move forward, and he took his own life. He felt betrayed by his work. He felt betrayed by his community, by any type of construct that he was involved in, including his family, sadly. And he didn't see a path forward for himself. And it was devastating to me. And it made me take stock in my own moments and what was going on with me. And truly looking back, you know, if it wasn't him, it could have possibly been me. Wow. So I took that opportunity to recalibrate. I had written an article about his passing, per se, and kind of betrayal as a theme. Mm-hmm. And that article exploded, and it hit like 75,000 people in about 48 hours. And I got a phone call from my buddy Michael, and goes, "Hey, someone just told me to check in on you. What's going on?" I'm like, "What do you mean, what's going on?" And they're like, he's like, "Well, you know, you being retired like 7 months out of the job now, you're out of the loop, and you've had no part of this whole, you know, internal support network, and your article is screaming out for help." Mm. And I'm like, "Oh, damn, I didn't even realize that." So somebody said, "You know, who's looking out for Dave, because he's not doing well." And Michael reached out. He was the newly minted chief resiliency officer for the county. Okay. And we had just started a resiliency program in the state of New Jersey at that time, which we can talk about more in detail going forward. But so he took me out to lunch with a guy named Pastor Barry. And Pastor Barry was kind of an advisor to Michael on the side. And they put me into the train the trainer program for the next class for the resiliency program. And I was like, "Wow, this is some pretty cool stuff." And it was based off of the Army and FBI National Academy's resiliency program that was originally instituted by University of Pennsylvania under Dr. Seligman. So I fell in love with it. I read the book Flourish. In the book Flourish, there's three paragraphs about the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology program. And I'm like, "Man, that looks really cool." So, you know, a year or two goes by, and I apply to the program, and lo and behold, they took this stupid door kicker into an Ivy League university. And here I am.
That's great.
So, yeah. What a story.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. And you know, when we look forward and we hope of what we're going to do in the future, or what our chapters look like in the book of life, you just never know what actually is going to come up, you know, and that first page is never what the rest of the chapter is going to look like.
Yeah.
So it's been a great, great, great experience. And I can't be more grateful and thankful for that.
Mm. Well, I have to say that we are deeply sorry for the loss of your friend, but I can say that the work you're doing is something that he would probably be so proud that you're mm-hmm. doing mm-hmm. because you're helping others and you're going to make sure that people have resilience and that they have options and they have strength to draw on when the time comes.
No, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, throughout Danny's, I'll call it the last three, four months, he was posting a lot of stuff on social media and I was like, oh, he's in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, reached out to him literally daily. I'm like, you're all right, dude. We, you know, and then just what cops do, we leave a case of beer on the front porch, which is probably not helpful either. He told me about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks before his passing. And he was, hey, I'm good. As long as I'm venting, I'm good. When you see me stop posting shit, no good anymore. No. I'm like, oh no. So, sure enough, it was probably, it was Friday. He had stopped like venting on social media. I'm like, Danny's got a problem. So I reached out to him, spoke to him on Sunday. He's like, yeah, I'm good, man. I just needed some head clearing time. And I'm like, all right, well, let's make some plans for this week. I know it's your son's birthday on Monday. And he's like, yeah, we'll do lunch on Friday. And then Tuesday morning, that was that.
Wow.
So yeah, it was wild. And my goal was to make sure that no one in my world ever sees that as an option for themselves ever again. So I know that's not realistic. I get that that's a 30,000 foot view. But I'm going to do it. And I told him in his passing that I will do anything in my power I can to make sure that this never happens to anyone ever again. And that's kind of how I ended up on this path.
Beautiful legacy then you're going to carry forward. You got a lot going on, so many things to talk about, but you did mention your book. Can you talk a little bit more about the book? It's called The Resilient Life, A Cop's Journey into the Pursuit of Purpose. Sounds like a very apropos title. So what's the book about and what do you most want people to take away from it?
So the book is about resiliency, but through the lens of my own experiences. It goes back into some of the stuff we've talked about, you know, the transgenerational trauma issues. It starts before me. It starts with my grandparents. Then it goes into my childhood experiences. It goes into my work experiences. There's some really funny work stories in there that are fun to share. And then it transitions into what I'm doing now at the end. But it also, throughout the book, it gives, resiliency tools at the end of each chapter or journey that I was part of to put almost a scientific lens on what I did to get out of those moments. Some of that was not known to me at the time, but looking back, I can see the tools that I used. Some of it was conscious, some of it was unconscious. But it's, you know, I wrote this book and it was published back in September, which was before I started the master's program at Penn. So it'll be interesting for me upon graduation to go back and look at the resiliency pieces that I included in the book through the lens of an uneducated, I don't say uneducated, but non-academic lens.
And, well, then you come out with the second edition.
Right? So my wife keeps saying the same thing.
Yeah, right. First the clinical one. Version.
Exactly.
David, can you give us a few tips on what did you do in order to stay resilient? You know, you're having a bad day, bad moment, whatever. What was your go-to?
So at this point, honestly, the simplest, the freest, most basic version is gratitude. If you can embrace the concept and the idea of gratitude, so many things will begin to unfold in front of you. And so many doors will open, so many windows open, the sun will shine in. Gratitude is really the go-to for so many different things. And it's free, right? Like we don't have to have a physical thing in our presence to be able to use that as a positive intervention. You just have to open your heart and your mind. And if you can share that gratitude with others, you'll be benefiting yourself, but at the same time, benefiting others in the process, right? The biggest piece of gratitude, which is probably the hardest, is to allow people to show gratitude towards you. If you can just embrace that, open your heart and let it in. But what's so important is to remember they are feeling good about themselves if you let that gratitude in.
True.
And not have to literally right away throw back, oh, thank you so much for that, and right. give them a compliment of some kind. Right. That doesn't do them any good, honestly. People want to be heard.
And I think first responders yeah. struggle with that, too.
Very much so. We don't say gratitude.
They're the givers.
Well.
They're the givers. Exactly. Let me give you a hand. You know, let me help everyone, you. It's hard
to receive. I see everyone struggling with that, Stacey.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of my professors, James Pawelski, he calls it the gratitude dance. So, you know, where it's just the gratitudes keep going back and forth and nobody's really appreciating them.
Yeah. I mean, it's like we don't have the skill. We have the skills of giving much better yeah. than the skills of receiving.
True.
Correct.
Yeah. But Stacey's right. I think it's such a common affliction with first responders to deflect.
Absolutely.
And if they yeah. actually listen to that family member who thanked them or the little kid, you know, who gave them the high five when they left, like those things could matter the world to you for the entire day.
Sure.
Absolutely. In our family, we like to do the gratitude bags. So we'll fill like a small Ziploc with candy and put a note in it. And we'll hand them out to flight crews. We'll hand them out to people in any type of service environment. And you said, nice. Thank you. Thank you for what you do. What you do makes my day better. So, and with a little bag of candy and, the kids were giving them out. I would do it to lift attendants at the ski, the skiing. Fine. So my favorite story about that, though, is we were at Butternut Ski Mountain in Western Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And there was a young man, is probably, I don't know, probably 16, 17 years old. You have to be 16 to work there. And he was cleaning the bathrooms. Clearly a lower socioeconomic status of a human, and that was his skill set, and he was cleaning the bathrooms. So I was in there, used the bathroom. I went to go wash my hands, and he kind of steps away. He had his earphones in, doing his work, and he steps away to let me use the sink. And then when I was done, I turned around and I handed him a gratitude bag, mm-hmm. and he went to go throw it in the garbage. Oh. I was like, whoa. He goes, what do you mean? He's like, that's for you, buddy. Like that. Thank you for the work that you're doing. So we have a clean environment, a clean bathroom to use. Mm-hmm. And he goes, seriously, this is for me? I was like, yeah, it's for you. Like it's candy, yeah. enjoy it, whatever, dude. If you don't right. like it, then throw it out. Yeah. Don't throw it out without looking at it. He goes, man, everybody just hands me garbage to throw away. I just assumed that you were the next person handing me garbage yeah. to throw away. He goes, no yeah. one's ever thanked me for cleaning the toilets before.
Yeah.
And he was like, and he started crying. Like, but so you make, there's just these little things that you can do to make other people's mm-hmm. lives better. And in the process, it makes you feel good because you made somebody else's day better.
Absolutely.
And gratitude's the way to go. Mm-hmm. I can't listen. There's a, 100 studied positive interventions. There's a lot out there, but, gratitude is always my go-to.
So what's your advice to first responders who are thinking about retirement or actively planning it? What would you tell them?
Wow, great question. Number one, retire with a purpose. Don't retire to quiet, silence, darkness. It's not healthy. You're not going to survive and you're not going to thrive. Also, a bunch of us joke, I'm going to just go to Walmart, be a Walmart greeter. It'll be simple. I don't have to think. That'll last about a week. And yeah. you're going to want something bigger and better, man, because that's just not. Retiring with purpose is probably the biggest recommendation that I can make. And make sure that you have a financial safety net, because unless you are retiring right into another job, your purpose may not be financially sound until somewhere down the road. So make sure you have that financial safety net. Make sure the day you get hired, being that, you know, 529 plan for your kids or 457 for your deferred retirement, save money because you're going to need it for a rainy day. Don't retire broke like a lot of us do. You know, I'm fortunate not to have been in that situation, but a lot of us are. Save your money, retire with purpose, and enjoy life. Just enjoy life and find ways to make yourself happy and thrive. Some things that will enhance your well-being.
Right. And of course, you've embodied the pursuit of being of service after retiring from the job. It seems like reading your resume, you've found multiple ways to be of service and really have found just a beautiful path forward after leaving law enforcement. And among all of that, you're a master resiliency trainer. So what is that? What does that look like? And how do you train people?
So being in the resiliency world, there's very different ways that you can be trained with resiliency skills. Everything started through the lens of positive psychology, through Dr. Seligman, through the University of Pennsylvania, through his colleagues around the country that have been studying positive psychology. But he's the one that put the name and the construct around that. And honestly, as a side note, studying under him now and him being my lead professor is just one of the greatest blessings of my life. Yeah. It's like, as one of our other professors say, it's like learning Buddhism from the Buddha. It really is. And he's just such an incredible human. And I couldn't be more thankful to be part of the program and learning from him. So resiliency is essentially using the framework of positive psychology with the construct of positive interventions to live a life of greater well-being. And it was originally worked through the Army, through Dr. Seligman in 2008, gave the Army this program. It was a top-down program where they had officers teaching enlisted. It didn't really go so great as far as that part of it goes. And then the Air Force took it over. And they split it. So enlisted were teaching enlisted, officers teaching officers. And then the FBI was like, wow, this is a pretty cool program too. So the FBI National Academy pulled into the program and put their spin on it. So the FBI National Academy came out and started teaching municipal police officers. And that's where we got the program here in New Jersey. I was trained as a resiliency program officer, which was like the next level down, but that was made up for New Jersey. Mm-hmm. There are now 1,200 resiliency officers in New Jersey that have given the resiliency framework to all 36,000 police officers in New Jersey. We're now expanding that out to prosecutors, other first responders. And then through a nonprofit called Resilient Minds on the Front Lines, which is the spinoff from my friend Michael, that was originally our resiliency officer in the county and the chief resiliency officer for the state, which is Rob Sepiel. Those two retired. Did a nonprofit version of the program. And that's where I trained additionally under them to get the master resiliency level. It's just more training of the same thing to be able to then teach back the information. We've brought that through the nonprofit. We've brought that program to the state of Georgia. They now have a full resiliency program. Pennsylvania's starting it. Tennessee's got a great program. Louisville, Kentucky has an incredible resiliency framework for their first responders. They just put their deputy chief is full into it. She just built a brand new building that's dedicated to first responder resiliency for their city. So there's definitely departments and agencies and constructs out there doing it. That it's special to watch it thrive and move forward.
Right, spreading.
It's incredible work, and it shows you that we're headed in the right direction with so many different angles. Right, and.
But I also get a little nervous about the difference between the self-help people that just have some great thoughts and ideas and are reposting memes versus the people that have scientifically looked at the study of resiliency, have the background and the research, and are then able to then, you know, put it forward in a constructive way. I think there's a really big difference there, and we just have to be careful that we're giving people good help and not bad help.
I think that's a fair point, and I think trusting your source, knowing, you know, where you're going for your information when you're looking up studies. You know, it's not just looking it up on Instagram in the search bar, right? It's going and finding sometimes the actual study or the university who sponsors the program, things like that, right? For Stacy and I, it's going to our EMDR governing body to look at EMDR therapy and some of those principles. So it's a fair point. Thanks. Yeah.
So David, like in terms of what you're teaching and some of the situations that you're seeing out there in different agencies, I guess I'm asking about the nuts and bolts with the resiliency training. What is it addressing, and then how does it kind of address those problems? What kind of tools are you providing agencies or the people in those agencies with?
Great question. So it's the resiliency class through Resilient Minds. I'll use them as the example because the state is a little bit different. They do a great job about laying down the positive psychology. 3-day class, by the way. It's a 3-day experience through them. They send out 4 instructors to each class, and they they open up by doing introductions. So everybody has to talk about themselves in a bit, introduce themselves to the class, which is a great way for you to get to know your colleagues in a way that you never knew them before. Mm-hmm. And then we go into the foundations of positive psychology, talking about PERMA, which is Dr. Seligman's theory, which is positive emotion and relationships and meaning and accomplishment and engagement. And within that framework, understanding what well-being means and what it looks like. Uh-huh. And then talking about different positive interventions like goal setting and active constructive listening. And we talk about gratitude. We talk about different ways that you can look at your problems or your life or even the good things, right? The study of well-being and positive psychology is about taking things from 0 to +1. It's non-therapeutic. It's skill building, it's life building, it's positive building, right? Moving away from 0 in a positive direction, where psychology as a study of itself is more therapeutic, it's more clinical, taking people from -1 up through 0 or beyond, but positive psychology kind of is the one that takes you away from 0 in the positive direction. So we talk about things like that, and it's a, you know, the tools that they get between goal settings at the end. And that's such an important piece to close with, because you take all of what you've learned. Now, how do you put it into practice? How do you affect your life in a way that you can take these tools and increase your well-being?
Well, that's fantastic. What kind of change do you see? Like, do you get feedback, and are there any kind of anecdotes you can share about how you've impacted?
Sure. When I've taught the classes through the nonprofit or through the state or in any of the other environments, my favorite is when you get that big burly guy who's probably on SWAT for 15 of his 20 years sitting back there. He was voluntold to be in the class. And, you know, this is rainbows and unicorn stuff. I'm not dealing with this and whatever. That's the first guy to cry. That's the first guy to have a breakthrough moment. That's the first person that's going to have the most benefits from the program. When you get them coming back the next day saying, I was soup on the floor in the kitchen talking to my wife about this. And she was like, I don't understand what's wrong with you. What happened? What did they do to you? Were you getting fired? Those people tend to recognize that their abrasiveness is a wall that they've put up subconsciously to protect themselves and their emotions from the things that they're going through, the things that they've seen, the things that are bothering them. And they've never tried to get over that wall. And when they come in the next day and they've kind of peeked over that wall to see what's on the other side, then that's when you can give them all of these tools that they'll now move forward with. So those experiences are great. I've never had anybody come out of one of these classes that says that they didn't think it was the best class they've ever had.
Wow.
And not saying that because of me, it's the resiliency and the positive psychology framework. Yeah. And what I always enjoyed hearing the first time I heard this was one of the instructors I was working with is this class is the only class in your career that you'll go to for you. So all of the other classes that you do along your career are to build a skill set for you to give back to the agency.
Yeah.
This is a class, or the resiliency or positive psychology is for you.
Right.
And it's the only thing you'll ever do to build your own wellness, to that opportunity to put your oxygen mask on first, so then you can help others in their pursuit of well-being.
Sure. Yeah. And you're providing a skill set that will probably range far beyond the end of a career and into the next chapter. Mm-hmm. So that's also an excellent gift that you're providing for all these people that are in your classes. Let's touch on, you know, where people can find you, where can people find your book and any other projects you have going on out there.
So my website is 64consultants.com. It's spelled out S-I-X, the number 4consultants.com. The links for the book are on there, both through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. If you happen to be in Western Massachusetts in the Berkshires, it's listed in all the bookstores there. And I do live in New Jersey, but we spend time up there, and so that's kind of why they're up there. But so Amazon, Barnes & Noble, my website has links to that. And LinkedIn is always an active platform for me as well. So if anybody wants to connect with me there, that would be a great spot to do it.
Excellent. Yeah, you have a lot of good content out there on LinkedIn. Well, David, thanks so much for being with us, having this conversation and sharing all your journey, through your career and into the next chapter. And thanks for all the great work you're doing out there in resilience.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you.
It's been great. Thanks, David.
Thank you, David.
Remember to like and subscribe. YouTube, Responder Resilience. Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV. BBSRadio.com, all the podcast platforms. And go to our website for past episodes and guest information. It's ResponderTV.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.